From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court ruled this week to raise the limit for individual campaign contributions from $123,000 to $3.6 million. It's not that the old limit was too low. Only a few hundred donors met it during the last election. But imposing limits was based on the idea that there needed to prevent deep-pocketed donors from corrupting or further corrupting the democratic process. The ruling in this case, McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission, much like the decision in Citizens United before it, rejects that argument in favor of one based on the idea that money is speech and speech should be free, or at least unfettered. Michael J. Copps, a former commissioner of the FCC, disagrees. But right now he's not arguing that point. He's stuck on a different one. Specifically, the FCC's old dictum that we are entitled to know by whom we are being persuaded.
All of America, I think, is exhausted from these endless, mindless, anonymous political advertisements. And most of them are really anonymous. A front group perhaps masquerading as Citizens for Purple Mountain Majesties and Amber Ways of Grain might really be a chemical company dumping sludge into the East River. But you wouldn't know that because they're not required to tell you who is really sponsoring these ads. A solution is at hand if we can get the FCC to do something about it.
It's tucked inside the Communications Act, where it has slumbered unenforced for decades.
In the law, and it's been there for almost 80 years now, is Section 317, which has to do with sponsorship identification, which means that people who sponsor ads, either commercial or political, on radio and now television and cable too, have a duty to inform people on who is really paying for the ads. This has never been enforced, even though it's been on the books all of these years, from the standpoint of the political aspects of it. It has been from the commercial. In the 1960s, the FCC updated the rules a little bit. I don't know why, because they never really implemented them, but they made it clear that the American people have a right to know by whom they are being persuaded. The FCC could say tomorrow morning, we're updating the rules. Here they are. You have 90 days to comment. We could have this in place for the 2014 elections, but we surely should have them in place before the 2016 elections. And again, that doesn't solve the problem of money, but I think a lot of those ads would maybe go away as a result of this. Wouldn't that be a blessing?
Okay, but a petition filed with the FCC nearly 3 years ago by the Media Access Project called for the law's disclosure requirements to be applied. It's just been sitting there. Why isn't the FCC acting?
Well, I pushed while I was there from the inside, and that wasn't sufficient to get that petition pulled out of the desk drawer. Now I'm pushing from the outside, and I'm hoping the forces of public opinion, fed-up voters, fed-up TV viewers, will join what I think is a rising chorus to have disclosure. And interestingly, in the Citizens United decision on political spending by the Supreme Court and in the McCutcheon decision this week that lifted aggregate contribution levels for individuals, both times the court said, we're not going to regulate the money, but there is an antidote, and that's disclosure. It's almost an invitation for the commission to update its sponsorship identification rules. So let's do it. We can do this now.
So what do you propose to do?
I propose that Americans raise their voices and let the Federal Communications Commission know you guys have the power to actually enhance the political environment. Please do it and do it now.
You want the public to send letters to the FCC?
Sure. There are allies in Congress. At hearings, the Senate Commerce Committee, Senator Nelson from Florida, was very strong on this. There are others. Chairman of the committee, Senator Rockefeller, evidenced a strong interest in this too.
The only way you think that the FCC might even be inclined to implement this rule is if there is a public outcry. Can you give me an example of when a grassroots effort actually forced the FCC to act?
Well, when I went to the FCC in 2001, the chairman at that time, Chairman Powell, was starting to think about loosening the media ownership rules. That was, how many outlets can one big media company own? And he wanted to fix it so that one company could own more and more outlets.
Chairman Michael Powell.
I think he and his Republican colleagues at that time thought this was an inside the Beltway issue and people really didn't care about it in the grassroots. And Commissioner Adelstein and myself thought otherwise. So we went and we had some hearings around the country and we worked with some senators and congressmen, went to their town hall meetings around the country, accepted invitations from groups like Free Press and Common Cause and others who were holding hearings. And as a result of all of this concerted action by a lot of people, 3 million people ended up writing to the FCC and to Congress. This was before the internet really took off. These were people sending in cards and letters. And lo and behold, when that happened, the Senate overturned those rules. And then the House expressed its disapproval. I remember talking to a member of Congress after that happened. And this member said, you know, I went home to a town hall meeting. And somebody raised their hand in the audience and said, what about media ownership? Nobody had ever asked me a question about media ownership. I didn't think it was an issue. And then he went back to Washington, and guess what? Voted to overturn the rules. So even in this age of outrageous money and the power of special interests, the grassroots can still prevail if it speaks loud and strong.
Not to be a wet blanket, but you were in the FCC and you and Commissioner Adelstein were able to hold those public meetings all over the country. You're not there now. Number two, now you're talking about the politician's own lunch, an issue that directly affects every sitting member of the political class.
Well, I'm not in the same position, but I'm going around the country. We'll be in Colorado next week. We were recently in Wisconsin. And I sense out there a real feeling that something is out of kilter here and we've got to fix it.
You need a bumper sticker. 317 lives.
Or prevails or survives, yeah.
Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Michael Copps is a former commissioner of the FCC and currently special advisor to the Media and Democracy Reform Project at Common Cause.
This week marked the deadline for signing up for the inaugural year of Obamacare. The website crashes bedeviled the rollout, and then again as the deadline neared, the White House says it has hit its projected number, 7 million new enrollees. This yielded high fives on MSNBC.
7.1 million people have signed up for the Affordable Care Act, and 15 million people have been affected by it.
But the truth of the claim depends on how you define 7 million and how you define new, and whether new enrollment is actually even the measure of the Affordable Care Act's success. Glenn Kessler, who writes the Fact Checker blog for the Washington Post, wrote this week that a lot of the numbers being thrown around by politicians in the media are based on fuzzy math. Glenn, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with the president's claim about the 7 million plus signups.
And despite several lost weeks out of the gate because of problems with the website, 7.1 million Americans have now signed up for private insurance plans through these marketplaces.
They selected a plan, but it doesn't mean that people have actually paid for it. And the general consensus is that at the moment, about 85% of the people who are saying they want to sign up for healthcare.gov end up making the first month's premium.
Now, a lot of the conversation in the multi-year buildup to the debut of the Affordable Care Act was the question of uninsured Americans. And so new enrollees became a currency. But what is really meant by new?
That's an excellent question, and it's not easily answered. At the moment, it looks like about two-thirds of the people who signed up for healthcare.gov are people who previously had insurance. At the same time, there are lots of people, 4 million, 5 million, who are now getting insurance for the first time through Medicaid, which is another part of the Affordable Care Act, a massive expansion of the Medicaid program. What that adds up to, we're not going to be able to find out for a few months.
And then there is a large category of young Americans who have been insured through their parents' policies but who would have lost their coverage having attained the age of, say, 18 or 21, now can stay on their parents' policies till 26. They're not new enrollees, but they would otherwise have become uninsured. How big a cohort is that?
Well, the administration cites a figure of about 3 million, but it hasn't been updated by the administration for 2 years. And I'm always suspicious when, you know, places like the Obama administration don't update their statistics. Probably means things have gone downhill. I've done my own looking at the data set that they relied on, and the numbers have dropped. It really works out to be about 2 million. And in fact, there's a new analysis that just came out this week that suggests it's actually less than a million.
Some politicians, for political advantage, will not only mix apples and oranges, they'll shake up the entire fruit basket. I'm thinking of Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, who earlier this week said this.
To date, over 10 million newly insured Americans benefiting from the health care law are now in effect.
You did a little detective work and were able to reconstruct how he came to this number.
One big part of that number includes that 3 million supposed young adults. If you don't trust that number, you got real problems with the rest of his number. There was a big number for Medicaid, nearly 5 million that was part of that figure. But again, the data on that is really fuzzy. And the 5 million estimate that Reid was relying on came from a survey that someone then extrapolated and added numbers to. It's not a number you could really trust. And finally, he was taking the idea that one-third of the 7 million enrollees on the healthcare.gov are newly insured. But again, we don't really know.
Here is House Speaker John Boehner 2 weeks ago talking about why Obamacare is a travesty that will destroy our society.
When you look at the 6 million Americans who've lost their policies, and some, they claim, 4.2 million people who've signed up, that would indicate to me a net loss of people with health insurance. And I actually do believe that to be the case.
So he does the arithmetic and finds out that the Affordable Care Act has actually left more Americans without coverage. Is there any truth to that?
No. It's actually pretty silly what the speaker did. He was taking a number, the number of people whose plans were canceled as a result of the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act, as you might remember, deemed some plans to be substandard. It didn't meet the requirements under the law. So there was a figure, maybe about 5 million, 6 million people, who received letters from their insurance company saying, your plan is not in compliance. But in many cases, those people just rolled over into a new plan that the insurance company offered, which was compliant with the law. What Boehner is doing, he's assuming that every one of those people lost their insurance and therefore are out there wandering the country without any insurance.
Now, Glenn, I've been reading your fact-checking work for years now, and I noticed that you are hesitant to use the L word. You try to be a little bit more clinical about what you do, but in the end, some people are just bigger liars than others. As you look at the statements coming from the Democrats and the Republicans, where are the biggest liars?
In terms of talking about the Obamacare numbers, I think I've given an equal number of four Pinocchio ratings to both Democrats and Republicans. You know, the Democrats are very eager to rush out and add up the best possible numbers that they can. The Republicans are quite happy to downgrade and subtract as much as they can. I don't think either side has covered themselves with much glory.
How can you tell when a politician is lying?
When they're talking about Obamacare.
Glenn, thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
Glenn Kessler writes the Fact Checker column for The Washington Post.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. A new report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC, is, yes, packed with evidence that global warming is a palpable threat. But the report departs from previous ones by offering a different sort of narrative, one that grapples with some of the most intractable challenges of covering climate change. We've been talking about those on this program for years, with journalists like Andrew Revkin of the New York Times.Earth blog.
Global warming is kind of like the Social Security and national debt of the environment. It's there. We all recognize it's some kind of big bad thing, but it's always kind of a someday somewhere story.
Heidi Cullen of Climate Central.
You know, we've really been trying to figure out how to cover it as a breaking weather story, so to speak, and it's not always easy.
And George Monbiot, columnist for The Guardian.
As people are confronted with really the inescapable evidence for climate change, they go into denial in the same way as we might go into denial when we go to the doctor and he says, I'm sorry to tell you, you've got cancer.
Christine Russell, science journalist and a senior fellow at Harvard's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs, says that this new IPCC report makes a media-ready case about climate change that can no longer reasonably be denied.
I think it's been seen as more abstract. It's happening to polar bears. And this new report and recent efforts really try to send the message that nobody is immune. Across continents, across oceans, virtually everywhere. That's a different message. An AP science writer named Seth Bornstein had a quote from a scientist that said, the polar bears are us.
What are the sorts of issues that the IPCC is pointing to that perhaps it hasn't emphasized so strongly in the past, say in the 2007 report?
Things like food, water, health, and security. In the food area, for example, they cite that there's evidence already of decreases in crop yields in wheat and corn. And as people are facing hunger and higher food prices, there could be conflict both within countries and across borders.
It's not saying that climate change will cause wars, is it?
No, it's really saying that things that we're already worrying about, if they get a bit worse, there can be a kind of tipping point. And they say that the signs are already there. It's not abstract. I mean, another area, of course, is water. Either too little of it, droughts, but also too much water with the flooding of coastal areas and particularly urban areas. So they're also talking more about climate refugees. And that's an area that has not been emphasized in these scientific reports as much in the past. Another issue that was raised in the report that was a little unusual from previous efforts is the impact of climate change on the economy. If there are increases in food prices, it's not just a problem for agriculture in Africa. It's already a problem in the U.S. All of the media surveys show the economy is the number one thing that the public is concerned about. And so that message has really been driven home.
And you're saying they didn't say these things in 2007?
They have dealt with impacts before, impacts on ecosystems, none of which kind of reverberate with the general public. This report is bolstered by a better PR approach. Also, much better science, which is really massive, 2,500 pages.
Now, in the past, the climate change skeptics have gotten a hold of the report and leaked it in an effort to cast doubt on the report's conclusions. I guess they tried that again this time. Tell me what happened, what the IPCC did differently. Because in the past, I think the IPCC tried to ignore those leaks, right?
Absolutely. What happened this time was, as far back as November, there was a leaked summary of the report as well as all 30 chapters in the draft report put up on a skeptic's website. The New York Times, the wire services, all wrote about it, but they tended to emphasize the report itself and not doubts being spread by the people who leaked it. The other thing was that in the past, you know, the IPCC has kind of just turned their head and said, no comment, no comment. This time, they've been much more media friendly. Ironically, in a way, the leaked version was used once again in recent weeks for people to write news stories. So the mainstream media largely ignored the climate denialists this time around.
There also seems to be, in this report, a greater emphasis on positive and effective actions that can be taken. Now, the notion that, as we've often heard, it's probably too late to do anything about climate change creates a kind of paralysis. Does the IPCC report try to counter that?
It definitely does. One of the co-chairs of the report, Chris Field, said he was actually optimistic that there could be actions taken to get ready for climate change, better planning for disasters such as hurricanes or flooding, trying to breed more drought or flood-resistant crops, and much more emphasis on saving water and energy. I think that is a different and new theme in the report as well. That kind of slight note of optimism was not emphasized by the media coverage. I think we're seeing a lot more attention, maybe more locally than in the national media, to what people can do, how cities can plan differently. And people sometimes don't believe things until they see it for themselves. I think the scientists are coming in and saying, look, we have more evidence. The evidence is piling up. And there's enough of a concern about extreme weather that people are starting to take it much more seriously.
Christine, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Christine Russell is a science journalist and senior fellow at Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center.
So maybe U.S. media are finally resisting the reflex to give equal time to climate change skeptics. But in Europe, where man's role in climate change has till now been largely undisputed in the media, the reverse is happening. In fact, the false balance tick has gotten so bad in the United Kingdom that Parliament felt the need to address the problem. A parliamentary committee issued a scathing report titled Communicating Climate Science, in which it laid out the chief offenders, the most egregious of which might surprise you. Bob Ward of the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at the London School of Economics was cited in the committee's work. Bob, welcome to the show.
Hi.
The sensationalist Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph were criticized, duh. But it was the BBC that really got a pasting. Tell me in what way?
The BBC plays a very important role in public debate on all issues in the UK because it is the most respected media organisation and has a public service responsibility. So the MPs, having looked at their coverage, found that whilst there were many examples of good coverage, there were too many examples of very poor coverage. In some programs, you found an almost pathological desire to balance, say, the contributions of climate scientists with so-called skeptics who reject the science.
The BBC declined to comment on our air, but it has circulated a statement in which it cites its commitment to impartiality, saying that, quote, it is important that dissenting voices are also heard.
The BBC has got a responsibility to be impartial, but it also has a statutory responsibility to ensure the accuracy of its output. It damages the public, not just because it gives a misleading impression of where the balance of expert opinion lies. The skeptics were often allowed to make demonstrably false statements, and too often it appears that the BBC sacrifices accuracy for the sake of an impartiality.
Bob, now I don't want to brag, but I believe that the United States is way ahead of Europe on the politicization of climate change, the notion that there is some sort of real debate going on. Is the UK catching up?
I'm afraid it is. The UK passed an act in 2008 with an overwhelming majority. And this Climate Change Act commits the UK to a statutory target for reducing its annual emissions of greenhouse gases by at least 80% by 2050 in the series of five-year budgets. But since 2009-2010, when there were scandals around the hacking of some emails from the climatic research unit at the University of East Anglia, which was then spread on the internet with accusations that it showed that climate scientists have been engaged in manipulating their data or committing fraud.
This was the so-called ClimateGate episode.
Yeah, that's ClimateGate, subsequently found to be complete nonsense, but it led to damaging headlines and extremely misleading media coverage, which we've never really recovered from. And we find in the UK that more than half of our national daily newspapers now pursue some sort of skeptic line. And public opinion surveys show that maybe 40% or so of the British public believe that there really is a significant level of disagreement between scientists about the role of man in climate change.
Bob, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Bob Ward is the Policy and Communications Director at the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at the London School of Economics. In December, Russian President Vladimir Putin appointed Russian TV personality Dmitry Kiselyov as head of the newly restructured state news agency Russia Today. In years past, it seemed unlikely that this up-and-coming journalist would serve as the head of a government propaganda network. Here he is back in 1999.
You cannot separate a journalist from ethics, but the people you see on the screen cannot often be called journalists, because often they are just agitators.
I wonder what the 1999 version of Dmitry Kiselyov would think of the more modern version.
According to published polls on Friday, Americans themselves consider Putin a much stronger leader than Obama. You can see this on diagrams. And Russia is the only country in the world that is, in reality, capable of turning the USA into radioactive ash.
That was Kiselyov just last month on his show News of the Week, which he hosts in addition to his role as de facto Minister of Propaganda. And it is that role that prompted Kiselyov's inclusion on a list of Russian and Ukrainian officials being sanctioned by the European Union for their part in the Russian takeover of Crimea. But according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, Joel Simon, including a journalist on such a list sets a dangerous precedent. Joel, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you.
I guess we better discuss the definition of journalist and whether a propagandist who self-identifies as journalist is necessarily eligible for the title.
Frankly, I'm not even sure where I come down on Kiselyov. He's grotesque. His comments are inflammatory. He's a pernicious and destructive force in Russian society. And there's no question that he definitely supported the Russian annexation of Crimea.
Just to give the listeners a notion of how incendiary this guy can be, here he is on the subject of gay rights.
They should prohibit them from donating blood and sperm. And their hearts, in case of an auto accident, should be buried in the ground or burned, as they are not suitable for continuing someone else's life.
As much as this guy frightens you and disgusts you, you are even more unnerved by the decision of the EU. Why?
Well, let's just say I'm uncomfortable with the decision. You know, where the line between propaganda and journalism begins and ends, that's a highly subjective judgment. When governments make that designation and say, you're a journalist, you're a propagandist, we know the difference between one and the other, and we're going to take action on that basis, that is a troubling precedent in many different contexts. The real issue in terms of sanctions, in my view, is did Kiselyov participate in incitement to violence, which is a criminal offense under any definition, and I'm not sure that he crossed the line.
On the subject of inciting violence, there is historical precedent for that. The International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda found a radio station partly responsible for the genocide when the Hutu broadcasters incited murderous mass violence against Tutsi civilians. So it happens, but that's not what Kiselyov is doing on News of the Week.
Right. The reason that we don't want governments making this distinction is because this distinction is the basis for lots of different kinds of action, including, in some cases, military action. Now, that military action can be justified under certain circumstances, as you mentioned. For example, incitement to genocide would certainly be a proper basis for that kind of intervention. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about speech that is inflammatory and disturbing and outrageous, but has not crossed the line into criminal speech. And that's why I think this designation is troubling.
I want to play the devil's advocate for you for a moment, and also the angel's advocate. Kiselyov may not himself be inciting violence, but he is the architect of a campaign of hate speech and lies that is giving political cover to the dubious activities of the Kremlin, and he's doing that explicitly for the Kremlin. Does this not make him a part of the apparatus of the Russian government and therefore as eligible for sanctions as anybody?
He's certainly played a noxious role, and he's put himself at the service of Putin and his political project, including his annexation of Crimea. But the Kremlin is exploiting this designation to suggest that the European Union has a double standard. And that is actually playing fairly well in Russia itself. So in some ways, this designation is playing into the hands of the Russian government.
Is the European Union's action going to make it easier for authoritarian governments to shut down freedom of expression in the future?
I think it could be useful because basically they're saying we've made a determination that this is not journalism, it's propaganda. And on that basis, we're taking action. If you put that in another context, we wouldn't be too happy if the Russian government or the Turkish government or the Venezuelan government was making that determination about the domestic media and acting on that basis.
The European Union has made this decision. They've kind of crunched the numbers and decided that Kiselyov is a legitimate target for sanctions. The United States has demurred on this. Do you know the calculus in the State Department that rendered them not to follow the Europeans in this sanction?
I don't have any insight into those discussions, but I will say that based on what I've seen of Kiselyov, everything he said is probably protected speech in a U.S. context. But that would not necessarily be true in a European context, where because of the history of the media in its role in inciting violence, particularly in World War II and even in the Balkan Wars, there are different standards. And it's not clear to me that his statements would be protected in a European context. And perhaps that explains the different decisions.
All right, Joel, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Joel Simon is executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists.
Coming up, we shed a tear for Television Without Pity, a website that arguably changed the way we talk about the little screen.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Hover, helping you get the best domain names to represent you or your business. If you want to get your ideas on the internet, Hover will help you find the right domain name and include all the tools and support you need to manage it. For 10% off your first purchase, go to hover.com and type in the promo code MEDIABLUFF.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. NBC Universal shuttered the beloved TV community Television Without Pity on Friday. The forums it spawned will close on May 31st. Television Without Pity started in the late 90s when Sarah D. Bunting and Tara Ariano launched a Dawson's Creek fan site. What ultimately evolved was a wide-ranging, often acerbic television recap and commentary website, which drew a vibrant community of passionate and opinionated viewers. I spoke with Bunting in 2003 about the hilarious and often caustic voice of the site.
I think the meanness, at least on my part, comes from this constant optimism that television is going to be good, that you realize it is possible for television to be important and to be a cultural through line, but there is also an element of laziness in a lot of television. And I think people accept that because television is like the redheaded stepchild of the arts.
It was the red-haired stepchild, but it's not anymore. It's now arguably top dog. Did TWAP, that's what its denizens call it, have anything to do with that? Ultimately, the TV dissection site was bought by NBC Universal in 2007 and now killed by SAME. I use dissection and not discussion because while Television Without Pity hosted endless discussion, it was known for its dissections, its meticulous examinations of scenes down to the second. Emily Nussbaum, the New Yorker's television critic, came to TWOP early and stayed and stayed.
Television Without Pity really did feel not just like a fan site, because fan sites were where people gathered just to praise the show and talk about their favorite characters. It actually did feel like a slightly crazy graduate school that was devoted to television. I've often referred to it as Talmudic, and it really did feel like that. TV shows were texts that you would really examine. And it was a two-part thing. There were these immense recaps that were often very sardonic and sometimes dismissive of the shows and sometimes celebratory, but for me, the forums were the heart of TWOP, and part of it was actually the combination of anonymity and extremely good moderation, to the point of fascist moderation. They had these very strong rules, and you could get booted, as I know, because I did get booted.
You got booted off of TWOP.
I did, because you weren't supposed to talk about the boards on the boards, not talk about Television Without Pity or the recappers. You had to talk about the shows. And this was to prevent things from going down the horrible internet rabbit hole.
Attacking each other.
It kept the conversation from turning into just a toxic swamp, as everybody has seen in discussion boards.
What show drew you to TWOP?
Buffy is really what drew me to thinking about TV this way, because it wasn't just people saying, we love Buffy. It really was people thinking seriously about the show as a myth, and also people talking about the way the show was made. On TWOP, people were very sophisticated about television and television making, and sometimes there would even be leaks. Like, I remember reading about a line that was cut from a script. And it just gave you a much stronger sense of television as this complicated artistic endeavor, in much the same way that a literature doctoral student would look at first drafts, consider the way that things had been affected by the publishing company. TWOP really had that attitude toward television, where anything about the making of it was also a source of great fascination.
But there are also forums of Buffy haters, right?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, there was a thread that was called the Deep Bitterness thread, I think. It was actually like a useful way to draw off the poison when people started getting mad at the show. So I think that was great and very therapeutic. And I would occasionally visit there because I was very curious about those feelings. The reason I feel like it was valuable was I feel like it did model this whole idea of taking television seriously enough to let it drive you crazy.
And what's really interesting is that Television Without Pity started at a time when TV really wasn't that good.
I mean, there were shows that were definitely worth thinking about in very deep ways in the mid-90s, ranging from The X-Files, Freaks and Geeks, My So-Called Life. But it always is interesting to me that a show like Dawson's Creek, I'm not saying it was a terrible show, but it was an annoying kind of pretentious teen drama. That's what drove the discussion. Also, I'd like to point out that even though it was an anonymous site, it was filled with people from Hollywood and journalism. They just used anonymous names. And there were constantly people who would post who worked on shows, for instance.
Aaron Sorkin went on the site during The West Wing.
Yes, to his detriment. He went on, he fought with people about The West Wing, which was a show that they were making fun of. It landed in the press, his fight with people on the site, because it was taking place in public. And then he wrote an episode into The West Wing that was actually a fictionalized version of his struggles with Television Without Pity. And he got to take revenge on the people there by describing them as wearing muumuus and chain smoking and all the sort of anti-internet stuff.
Hi, Sugar Lips.
I'm sorry?
Donna struck gold.
What is it?
LemonLyman.com.
What is it?
There's a website devoted to all things Josh.
You're kidding me.
No. Right now, we're viewing the section devoted to the Josh fantasy date. This, it should be painfully self-explanatory, is where the women and more than a few men, I've got to say, discuss what they would do with you if
all right, can everybody who doesn't work here please go work where they work?
This has come up in a lot of Sorkin shows, but, you know, he wasn't the only person to go on the sites. This was a place that people who made television shows went. It had a fraught relationship with Hollywood. They'd be panned by these powerful yet anonymous figures. It was a sign of that moment that the internet began to shift in power. Sometimes people were literally like, why didn't they listen to us? We told them not to use the word champion again on Angel. Like, I remember this discussion and I was like, you know, it doesn't really work like that. Some of the best television creators responded against the fanhood. And actually, that often creates the best TV. I mean, there's David Simon and Joss Whedon, Matt Wiener. Everybody has made these remarks where they just go, basically, I give the audience what they need and not what they want. That tends to drive people crazy. But of course, that has to be the attitude of an artist. The goal is not to satisfy these ravenous, perseverating masses who are gathered online. That way madness lies. Even if you care about the audience, nobody can make art that way. But that doesn't matter. The conversation's value is not in how it changed the art. The conversation's value is in both how it changed the people having the conversation and in how it changed people's expectations and response to the art, how people treated TV.
Given that there are so many sites that provide an environment for this kind of discussion, does this warrant more than a historical footnote?
Of course, there are millions of places online that people talk about television now, and in very TWAP-like ways. I mean, honestly, even Reddit has really rich, smart discussions about television. I miss TWAP's centralized feeling where you could go there and every show was there. But of course, TWAP was bought and it was turned into like a zombie version of itself. There's been problems with the site, I believe, for years. I simply wish that Television Without Pity in its old form could still exist, because I think the combination of having a centralized place where people can discuss any television show with highly moderated, well-structured forums is an invaluable thing.
What's the legacy of TV Without Pity? Did it spawn these other sites or is it something else?
Television is an art form that's extremely defined by its relationship with its audience. And it's one of the qualities that makes it different than, say, movies or novels. It takes place over time, and the creation of it changes in relationship to audience response. And Television Without Pity was a site that came out right at the moment that TV itself was going through a big jolting transition in terms of its ambition. And the crazy thing about that site was it's a record of audience response. Television Without Pity modeled an attitude toward television that was both celebratory and at times acridly critical. It was actually a new way of thinking of yourself as an audience member, as somebody who was actually allowed to think deeply about what you were watching and expect it to be beautiful and transcendent. That's what formed the environment that we have today. And I think it's a good one because the best things on TV are fantastic and well worth talking about in exactly the way that they talked about them on that site.
Emily, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Emily Nussbaum is the television critic for The New Yorker.
YouTube is infamous for hosting one of the worst comment sections on the internet, and there's no reason ever to read a YouTube comment, unless you're writer and filmmaker Mark Slutsky. Mark spends hours scouring the comment section on YouTube, and sometimes, scattered in the dross, he finds small, poignant stories. OTM producer PJ Vogt, who co-hosts our weird internet-y spin-off podcast, TLDR, tracked Mark down to learn about his quest to find beauty in one of the internet's ugliest places.
Mark's a writer and a filmmaker in Montreal. A while ago, he was procrastinating, and he found himself just clicking through pages and pages of the YouTube comments on pop songs. The reason he kept coming back was because occasionally, scattered in the dross, he'd find these tiny, poignant stories that really surprised him.
They just seemed so ephemeral, you know. It seemed like they could disappear at any moment. They could sort of be buried under 100 or 1,000 stupid new comments, or the video could be deleted. And I thought that somebody had to sort of save them.
So that's what Mark does. He's created this blog called Sad YouTube, where he collects the stories that he finds. In some cases, he's actually tracked down the people who posted the comments and then interviewed them about their lives. The result's really surprising. It's a document that proves that there's truth and humanity in YouTube comments, the internet's bleakest corner, the place that all of us have learned to just walk past.
People go, they're fooling around, they're like checking out old songs, and all of a sudden, an unexpected memory will just sort of ambush them. And the YouTube comment box is right there for them.
What were some that you liked?
So there's this old disco song by a French band called Voyage, and the song is called Souvenirs. Which means memories in French, which is, just appropriate. And I found this comment on it. I would like to send you a memory. I was 13, walked to the projects across the street in Manhattan. This song was played from an apartment on the 8th floor so loudly and clearly. I grabbed a kid and danced the hustle with her for maybe an hour. It felt so great to be alive and feel free to dance in the streets, parks, or a cafeteria during lunch. The boomboxes played this on the subway platform. We broke out dancing the hustle waiting for the train. The hustle was sexy and graceful. Never got tired.
There's a Portuguese word, saudade, which doesn't really translate to English. But it means nostalgia and melancholy, just longing for this place that you've lost. Mark is a bloodhound for that feeling. Listen to this comment he found, which was posted on the song Telephone Lines by ELO.
How are you? Have you been all right? Through all those lonely, 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 lonely.
I remember the first time I heard this song. It was late night, early July, 77. I was in the Navy and home on leave after graduating A school with orders to a destroyer in the Western Pacific. The next morning, I was to fly from my home in Boston to California, and then from Travis Air Force Base to the Philippines. Halfway around the world, to where I didn't know a single soul, I thought of girls I knew in high school and wondered what they were doing. This song really resonated with me that night. You know what's interesting? That's the second mention of Travis Air Force Base in a sad YouTube comment.
Really?
Yeah.
What was the first one?
The other one is one of my favorites of all time. It's on the video for Downtown by Petula Clark.
Wait, is that like the Downtown that I'm thinking of?
Yeah. You know, when you're alone.
Life is making you lonely. You can always go.
That Downtown.
Yeah.
I'll read the comment to you if you want.
Yeah, please.
High school. After lunch, some of the girls would dance on the gym floor before classes. Beth, Joellen, Nina, to name a few. The song had come out, and they just danced to it. I remember sitting and waiting for my favorite girl to come out. When she did, my heartbeat sped up till I thought I would pass out. When you're alone, she knew I was there. Life is making you lonely, you can't. I heard it at Travis Air Force Base before going to Nam. Downtown, I just cried while waiting to board the plane.
All the noise and the hurry seems to help, I know.
Downtown. What I love about that one is it's a sort of double memory. He remembers these girls dancing on the gym floor. And then it's sort of this almost a cinematic cut where all of a sudden he's at Travis Air Force Base waiting to get on a plane to Vietnam, remembering that earlier memory.
Mark spent hundreds of hours just staring at these YouTube threads. He says at some point he developed this sixth sense, where he can just skim down a page and the good comments will jump out to him. But YouTube's making it a lot harder. In November, they instituted this change which very strongly encourages commenters to use their real names. It's good for everybody who wants less vitriol on the site, but it's bad for Mark because it means that some stories just aren't going to get shared.
Because some of it is just too personal. There's this really, really poignant comment on an old Herb Alpert song. Okay, so the song is called This Guy's in Love with You.
You see this guy. This guy's in love with you.
Last year of high school for me, 1967. Yes, my best friend and his girlfriend, who we were both in love with, though he never knew. Haven't seen her in 35 plus years. You always remember the ones who got away. Never told anybody. Their song.
I can't tell we know each other very well.
It's really sort of like precious memory, and the commenter's name is Wanker4761.
That's, I think, everything I love about the internet is in that.
I've heard some talk. They say,
you know, I think 90% of the comments I found have been on bootleg uploads, you know, technically illegal uploads of old songs, and they're all kind of doomed. Eventually, a lawyer or, you know, some sort of copyright practice will flag them and they'll get taken down, and the comments just disappear with them.
I don't know. I am so on the side of saving things and saving ephemera. I feel like in your piece, there's like a real sense of like loss and sadness that these things are going away faster than you can save them. But like, I also understand that this is just mountains of crap also.
Well, you know, when an archaeologist wants to learn about a civilization and wants to learn about how people live day to day in that civilization, they go through the garbage. And that's what I feel like I'm doing.
Writer and filmmaker Mark Slutsky with our very own PJ Vogt. For more TLDR podcasts, subscribe to our feed on iTunes and go to onthemedia.org for TLDR, the blog. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Dirkman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Mira Sharma, and Kimmy Regler. We had more help from Cameron Lindsay, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippon.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.